When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien Podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is chisme ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 139 of the world's first Paul Weller fan podcast. I'm Dan Jennings, and 10 years ago, I gave up my live streaming career as a radio presenter with one big regret. Never getting to interview my hero, the legendary singer, songwriter, and musician, Paul Weller. This podcast exists purely to solve that issue. Welcome to Desperately Seeking Paul. Something a little bit different this week on the podcast as we celebrate the release of Paul Weller's new book, Magic, A Journal of Song, through a conversation with its curator, journalist, and author, Dylan Jones. The book takes us from in the city to fat pop songwriting, from the jam in Paul Weller's teenage years to creating the Style Council, through to his years as a solo musician. We have 120 songs spanning his entire musical career. It's Weller at his most candid and intimate account of his musical life to date, as told to Dylan Jones, a previous podcast guest. So something a bit different on this week, as I say. Let's get into it. Dylan Jones, thanks for joining me.
Pleasure. Very nice to be here.
Lovely to see you again. Now, we spoke back in July 2021, believe it or not. I mean, goodness me, time flies, right? And at that time, there was no mention of Magic, A Journal of Song by Paul Weller with Dylan Jones. This was new news that came in after our podcast recording. And as soon as it did, I was like, oh man, I missed something there. Presumably, this was all in train at that moment in time. You just couldn't tell me about it, right?
I think it probably was. I think that over the last sort of 4 or 5 years, I suppose, I've done a lot of journalistic work with Paul. As we all know, during that period, each record has been sort of better than the one before. He's been going through a real purple patch, releasing so many great records that I think there's even been instructions from his management to calm down a bit because he's marked it with all this extraordinary material. But in all seriousness, then we did a series of podcasts. Was that 20 or 21? I can't remember which year it was.
It would have been 20 because it was on Sunset Time, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. It seemed to go very well. I certainly enjoyed it, and I think unusually Paul did, because I think he often views these things as any sort of publicity as being sort of necessary evil. I don't think he loves it, but I think we got on well enough to consider doing this book. And when it was suggested, I have to say I was incredibly excited, because certainly giving the amount of time that he gave was a big ask. But he did it brilliantly. He was enthusiastic. I hope that we spoke about things that he's never spoken about before. So from my point of view, it's a completely joyous experience.
I also think, you know, if you imagine yourself that teenager that we talked about when you were on the podcast before, you know, the Nag's Head, High Wycombe, May 1977. And here we are all this time later. I mean, this is as close as we're ever going to get, I think, to a Paul Weller autobiography, really. Could you imagine that?
No, of course I couldn't. However, I mean, it shows you how life and time plays tricks with you. I remember going to see Paul play the Albert Hall in kind of 92, maybe, which is probably, you know, the 15 years after I first saw him. I'm wearing a suit, he's wearing a suit, and I'm thinking, this is very odd, this is very strange. We've both come a long way. I never thought we'd arrive at this stage, but I do think you're right. I think it's the closest that Paul will probably ever do to writing his autobiography.
You've decided in terms of the narrative to start at the beginning, and we run through every album. But also, the really interesting bit is there are four sections. Most people, you go, okay, the Jam, the Style Council, Paul Weller solo. But no. We've got the Jam, the Style Council. We've got Going Solo, so those early years you just mentioned there. But then the Purple Years, which again, you just referred to. How did you decide how to break up the book in that way?
Common sense, I think. And also, I don't think either of us wanted to do anything that was too tricksy. Paul went to great lengths to encourage me to write as much as possible. But I deliberately wanted it to be his book. I kind of rein myself in because people are buying this book for him, not for me. But I think it was important to have the later section because I think that if you take most artists, and I think we can talk about most great artists too, they don't make their great work towards the end of their career or towards the latter part of their career. And much as I love people like Brian Wilson and The Who, and I mean, lots of people, you can pick any great artist that we all love and revere. It's unlikely that they're going to make their very, very best work 30 or 40 or 50 years after they first appeared. It's just very unusual. People have a narrative arc. Neil Tennant says, I think he calls it the kind of regal period, the imperial period. He calls it something. And I think it's right. And a lot of artists, you kind of work this out mathematically, perhaps sort of have a 7-year period in which they are imperious and they create their greatest work. That's possibly based on the lifespan, the professional lifespan of the Beatles. But yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge that Paul Weller is one of the few people to have bucked that post-war 70-year trend, because I think that the half a dozen records he's made in the last half a dozen years have been absolutely extraordinary. And I think that anyone who knows or cares about his work would agree with me.
Obviously, I don't want to give away too many spoilers because people are eagerly waiting their book arriving, and trust me, you're not going to be disappointed. It's a beautiful publication, not least the words and the story of Paul, but the photographs, everything that's packaged within it is absolutely stunning. But there are so many bits where you're right, Paul talking for the very first time about certain elements, and we'll dig into some of those stories. I want to start right back at the beginning and how it all started, you know, in the city, and the fact that he's talking about how few original songs they had. I think 40% of their stage set list he was talking about were covers, and this was right at the beginning of like 76, so not far from them being catapulted onto into the record deal and the albums and all that kind of stuff. But he's quite critical of the early albums, isn't he? He's kind of, you know, going, there are little moments on them, but they're not great.
Well, I think one of Paul's most appealing traits is he's a very harsh critic of his, I mean, he's a very harsh critic of other people's work too, but he's an incredibly harsh critic of his own work. And yes, I think he looks back at those records as being innovative, groundbreaking, disruptive, etc., etc. But I think he considers some of the songwriting and some of the performances to be kind of under par. But then they were newbies; they were fresh out of the box. And even though the band had a big touring history, you go into a recording studio for the first time. It's a novel experience. However, I think that you can take sort of half a dozen songs from the first album and some from the second album, which are kind of extraordinary. Perhaps taken as a whole, those records aren't amazing in the grand scheme of things, but they certainly lay the foundation for what came later.
He also talks about very early on being always being into melodies, and this is something that weaves its way throughout the whole book actually, but he talks about from a really young age actually being able to see the craft of songwriting, seeing as a thing with his favorite bands, the bands he loved, the Beatles, the Who, you mentioned the Kinks, people like that, and listening to these melodies filling his head with images and thoughts, which again we see then transported into so many of his songs. But that came from a really young age, didn't it?
Yes, it did. There's a salient difference between having the ability to soak up influences and to be inspired by music and landscape and books and poetry and film and fashion and sociology and politics. I think there's a difference between that and having the ability to actually fuse that into melody. Because I think that, again, returning to that idea of people, artists, entertainers, musicians, songwriters, perhaps not writing their best material towards sort of middle to later period of their careers, I don't think people lose the dynamism. They don't lose the excitement. They obviously are far more experienced, and they often have the same principles, and they're more adept at channeling the DNA of what they do and what they are, but they might not get better at articulating it or indeed wrapping that in melody. There was a great piece in the New Yorker a few years ago about McCartney, and it was talking about his proficiency as a songwriter, but it was less about his proficiency as a songwriter and more about his ability to write melody. And I think Weller's like that. I think Paul's like that, that he can write melodies. And lots of people run out of melody. Hmm. And he hasn't. Not yet, anyway.
There's a bit where you talk about, actually much later in his career, but one of those recent Purple Patch albums, True Meanings. And ultimately, you know, saying, you know, it's an absolute masterpiece, but the fact that you can hum every song. And I love that. I thought, I was like, yeah, you're absolutely right. But that comes back to that melody point, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think there was always a suspicion, particularly in the early punk days. Melody was, it was perceived to be kind of old school. And there's the famous sort of English Rose story, which Paul elaborates on in the book. Being somehow embarrassed to write something that was that intricate, that melodic, and perhaps that personal and that sort of soft. Because I think in the first couple of years of punk, everything had to be hard, with a hard edge, and everyone was angry. And of course, that was part of the excitement. But to deny melody and to deny craftsmanship and the art of songwriting was quite soon seen to be a bit bonkers. But you're right, you take an album like True Meanings and everyone's a winner.
Obviously, this is a book. There's plenty of words, over 25,000 of them. And he talks about writing and how he writes lyrics throughout the book as well. Let's talk about Setting Suns, because this is one where he said, first of all, that the songs came from the words. It was a very wordy album, was how he described it. And the whole album being very much lyrics first. And I'd forgotten this, because now we listen to music on, you know, on the Alexa speaker and we, you know, shout at the speaker in the corner and get it to play things. But I'd forgotten songs like Burning Sky being a letter. When you see it laid out in your book and you look back at the sleeve notes of the album again, you're like, oh yeah, it was. There was a deer at the beginning and a yours at the end and stuff. But the words on that album particularly really seem to attach themselves to the audience, but they just meant so much to people. But he's always loved the written word, hasn't he? Not just in terms of songs, but poetry, all that.
And that certainly started to come true or come to the fore in the sort of third and fourth Jam albums. There were obviously periods where he was far more into the sound, the sonic, when the Jam went through the kind of Gang of Four period. And he was taking that idea of modernism in a very particular way. But yeah, the art and the craft of writing, not just songwriting, but writing is very important to Paul. And he developed a way to channel that into pop. And when it really works, like in any great pop medium, the great pop single, the great pop song is when those two things fuse together. I mean, Sound Effects is probably my favorite Jam album because it fuses a very keen sense of lyrical kind of bite with a genuine attempt, a successful attempt to change the sound of the band and become even more modernist than they were. Because I think by 79, 80, 81, there was a sense that a lot of what punk was doing in 76, 77, 78 was actually, it wasn't modernist. It was actually quite conservative and quite old fashioned. So there was a determination to make a quantum shift. And Paul certainly achieved that, I think.
You mentioned Sound Effects. There's a bit in the book as well where, and again, I don't want to give too many spoilers away, but I've not heard Paul talk about this before. The love of Off the Wall, Michael Jackson's Off the Wall at the time, and that feeding into songs, although you might not hear it, but feeding into songs initially, like Pretty Green, for instance. So there are some of the influences that come through in the book that he talks about that I've not heard him talk about before.
Well, that's very true. And I think that's a very interesting point that you picked up on that, because not only has he not expressed an interest publicly in that record before, but it's also very different to draw a line between that record and the record he made. In fact, I would say it's almost impossible. But it's fascinating because that influence obviously manifested itself in a very particular way.
The other thing that comes through a lot in the book is his uncomfortable relationship with fame.
Yeah.
And really kicking off when, you know, going underground was the Jam at their peak. And he talks about having to start making records that sounded different after that. But this fame at that point, you know, they were topping the charts. It really doesn't sit well with him, does it?
No, I mean, I don't think that's a surprise. I think that he perhaps becomes more prepared to talk about that. Because I think initially when someone is in the entertainment industry, and I know people don't like to think they are in the entertainment industry, but they are in the entertainment industry, and wanting success is deemed to be one of the pivotal motivators of being an entertainer. When you shun that, or when you publicly sort of decry it, or say you're not interested in this level of fame, in the way that George Michael did, for instance, many people did, Paul McCartney did for a while, or if you're someone like Sade, you just say, I have literally no interest, not only in being famous, but also engaging in that process. And it's not done in a kind of mean-spirited way. It's done in a very particular way. And I think you ultimately have to admire Paul for that. In fact, I don't even think you have to admire it. You just have to accept it. And all of that stuff about when he became a solo artist and he had to get back on the road to make money, to reestablish himself. And again, he got back to a level of fame he probably hadn't achieved since the early 80s. And I think a lot of cynics would say, well, you should be happy with that. And I think it's a genuine thing. It's like after you've experienced extraordinary fame, I think some people have a huge issue with it. Mark Knopfler is another one. Mark Knopfler could be responsible for probably the biggest touring band in the world if he only reformed Dire Straits. But he has no interest in doing that. And you know what? Why should he?
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting when he's talking about that level of fame when he's back on like Standy Road level and how he was going to, you know, parties, whatever, but just felt he's so sycophantic. Like everybody was laughing at his jokes. He just didn't know who were true friends, all that stuff. And almost that paranoia kicks in a way.
Well, I think it does. I think it calls into question critical acclaim and popularity. And I think that one of the things that Paul certainly has, he has a very good radar, not just for external bullshit, but for all, also to temper his inclination to wander off in particular directions or pursue particular directions. Like I said earlier, he's a very harsh critic of his own work and his own motivations.
The Style Council is a great section of the book because, I mean, not least lyrically, obviously, you know, a real social reflection of the times in these beautiful, catchy pop songs. And you put it so brilliantly. You kind of say, on the one hand, this allowed Paul to an opportunity to reinvent himself on a daily basis. And on the other hand, the band freed him up as a writer. But ultimately, he wanted to try something different. But the one thing I wonder reading it is whether that approach to trying new things all the time maybe confused fans at points where, yes, there's a benefit to not knowing what you're going to get, but quite a lot of the audience would have loved an Our Favourite Shot Part 2, you know?
Yeah, but I think every artist or every performer, not every artist, but the ones who operate in this particular area are very aware of that. And you only have to look at the template of the Beatles to understand that almost none of their records were similar to the ones that preceded them, perhaps for the first couple of years. But after that, there was a deliberate policy to confound people. Why don't we do X? And actually, that ambition is no different from what Paul was doing with Style Council in the early 80s. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that myself included, there were lots of things we said, well, wouldn't it be great to have an album like that, that just sounded like the Isley Brothers, the Long Hot Summer period? But why should it? You know,
there's another influence, actually, thinking about it, the Long Hot Summer, where he talks about Nina Simone. And I've not heard him mention that before, but how, like, what such a huge influence she was on his writing around that time.
Yeah, and I think that because critics often look at things from a stylistic point of view and think, well, he doesn't make records that sound like any records that Nina Simone has made, so this is strange and odd and a little bit sort of left field. But it's often to do with influences, it's to do with song structure, it's to do with mood, it's to do with feel, it's to do with lots of different things. And I think that as well as sitting down and having an instinctive musical flex in an ability to write a song, there's also the determination to write lyric in a very particular way using different structures. That's what makes him someone who was developed as an artist. I hate using that word, but as were developed as someone who creates, and perhaps why the last half a dozen records have been so extraordinary.
Did you get a sense from your conversations with Paul? I do think this comes through in the book as well, where that comes from, of that constantly wanting to push forward, constantly want to create his best work. There's a wonderful moment in the book, actually, where he talks about, I can't remember off the top of my head what the song was, he talks about writing a song and feeling like he'd written the perfect song.
Yeah.
And then, like, that was the point. If, and he promised himself, if he ever felt like he'd done that, that would be it. He'd give up. Maybe it was aspects of it. But actually, he's decided then to kind of go again. And if I could did it once, maybe I can do it again. But that seems to just be inherent in him. He's just always pushing for the next thing.
Well, I think you have to. And he understands that. And he also understands it during a period where he still has the ability to conjure up those great songs. But he is due a stinker.
Have you told him that?
I haven't, but he is due a stinker. He can wear that.
Yeah. No, you're right. Just the math. Yeah.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Confidence starts with loving who you are. And when your skin feels nourished and glows on the outside, you naturally radiate confidence from the inside. Give your skin a glow up with Osea's clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This ultra-hydrating body care features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. These seaweed-powered heroes use skincare-level ingredients normally reserved for your face for results you can see and confidence you can feel. Osea has been making clean, clinically proven seaweed-infused face and body care products for over 28 years. This luxurious skincare is vegan, cruelty-free, and climate-neutral certified, so you never have to choose between your values and your best skin. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.
There was a couple of other things about this, about his songwriting process come through. One is he talks about the fact it hasn't really ever changed in the sense it's black pen writing lyrics, but he talks about the fact the melody side of things, maybe now he's using technology, he's putting voice notes into the phone, he's singing things in the middle of the night into his phone by the side of his bed or whatever. But then there's this heartbreaking moment where he mentions the fact that every year or so he just deletes those all off his phone, anything that hasn't gone into the recording process, gone the lot.
I quite like that though. It's like, yeah, get rid, move on.
Some people would put that into, you know, multiple deluxe versions of albums, you know.
Oh, and they do, don't they? There was a friend of mine who took great delight in he'd just bought the new box set of a particular artist, and it had everything in it. It had 80 versions of this one, blah blah blah. And I said, you're going to play it once, and you'll find it fascinating, but you will never, ever, ever play it twice. And of course, he never will.
Yeah. He also talks about that studio process. So, and back to the Style Council, you know, Solid Bond being a real game changer. But I thought it was really interesting because he talks almost about it being almost like a 9-to-5. It's like Monday to Friday, they're checking in, they're doing the work, but this real creative playground. And I think you've talked about Black Barn and how important that is to him now and has been. You know, just think about this Purple Patch, 22 Dreams onwards and stuff. That importance of him having a safe space to operate in and to be creative definitely comes through in the book.
Well, that's good. I think it's true. You need somewhere to go to work. And Solid Bond is literally 200 yards from where I live.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I walk past it every day. But yeah, I think the barn is his sanctuary. And I don't think luck's got anything to do with it. I think he's created it like that, where it's where he goes to work, and he can be creative anywhere, but that's where he goes to extemporize the craft, to do the stuff. You know, it's the pop factory.
And he talks about, like, you know, he'd be happy never to leave. It's that good.
I think that's very true, actually. If it wasn't for sleeping and going on tour, I think he'd be very happy to spend all day, all week, all month, all year there, frankly.
One of the things about the book as well, you have the lyrics and then we have the commentary, right? So you're reading the words and then we're, you know, talking about the songs or the moments in time when, you know, where he was in his life at that moment in time as well. And I found it fascinating seeing him talking about the political lyrics of the Style Council and how a lot of people ask him, you know, why he doesn't write those types of songs now. Why does he doesn't write those political songs like he used to? And this is an amazing comment. He's kind of saying that actually I'm better off singing the same ones I wrote, you know, 30 years ago, because they're the same issues. They're the same. It's a bit sad, really, isn't it? It's the same issues, the same arguments. And those songs still resonate and have exactly the same meaning as they do today.
Yeah, I think that was a very perceptive thing of him to say, not just the fact that political regimes mirror each other, but the fact that I think if you've sung heartily in your youth, I think that the echoes of that will probably stay with you. And I think it can get very tricky for people going down a particular path, writing about politics, particularly when they're writing it from a point of privilege. I think that's slightly problematic sometimes because there's an authenticity there that inevitably feels a bit bogus. But those are rebel songs. Those are protest songs, and they remain as important and as sort of hard edged as they were back in the early 80s.
The thing is, we get into the solo years, and like I say, two sections. So there is that return of Mr. Weller. And I found it fascinating where he's talking about, you mentioned like his dad saying to him, look, we're skinned, we have to get back on the road. But also this idea at the time that he wasn't feeling creative. And I suppose when you talk about that 7-year thing, actually, we've done the 7 years at that point, right? We've done the Jam, we've done the Style Council, more than that, actually. But in terms of like the that purple patch, if you like, that would have been enough for most careers. But actually, you know, obviously we have the last 30 years of this incredible solo career as well. But he wasn't feeling creative at all at the beginning. He said about it, like he'd write stuff down during the night and then throw it away the next day. He had no interest in playing music at all.
Well, I think that's also a very important to have that ability to know when you haven't got it. I think it's very important because lots of artists don't. They will just keep pumping out material, possibly even knowing that it's substandard. And when you look back, when you have a career as long as Paul's is, it's you don't want it littered with speed bumps. It's difficult. Everyone's had clunkers, but he's had fewer than most, I think.
One of the things I think about your approach to the book and the conversation you've got from, and obviously he was really up for this. You've built this comfort zone where he can share things he's not shared before, which I loved. But he does talk about the dark times, the darkness in him. And you do get a sense of this actually when you dig into some of the lyrics, perhaps, that there's some of this as well. But there were some real years when he was really quite unhappy and the drinking was out of control. The partying was out of control. And it's back to the thing, I guess, where you see this fella on top of the world in your mind, right? Here he is, this huge big star and is, you know, on the world stage, but actually that's just one side of him. And, you know, actually there's a human being behind these songs, behind the performer. And there were periods where he was really low. It was quite dark, wasn't it?
Well, I think that's why, for me as a journalist, that there are parts of the book which I find professionally fascinating, because he talks about addiction and he talks about excess and he talks about his own issues with drink primarily. I wasn't pressing him to talk about that because we were talking about stages of his life. We were talking about the work. And I think it's because the conversations were about work. They weren't about his personal life. They weren't about musician relationship. We weren't talking about the sort of arc. We were talking, I suppose, about product and about work and about craft in isolation. And because creativity, it's personal. He was talking about where he was personally at the time when he was writing those songs. So for me, when he talks unguardedly, I think quite unguardedly, about the dark periods of excess and addiction, I find that fascinating. And as I say, I wasn't prompting him. I wasn't leading him in that direction. But I think he was incredibly honest. And I think what he says also is a really interesting reflection and counterpoint to what he was doing artistically at the time, and perhaps sheds a lot of light on what's happened since. Because I think there's also that fear that a lot of artists have. It's the things that are meant to sort of stultify you as a creator, or nullify you as a creator. It's the pram in the hall, it's domesticity. It's stopping. I won't be able to create again if I stop drinking, taking drugs, doing this, that, and the other. And he's certainly come through that, because it's patently not true. I think that his ability to conquer any demons that he has resulted in better work, not worse work.
It sounds like a terrible love-in, doesn't it? In fact, I read a rather snide review in a music magazine, one of the few music magazines left, saying that I was too positive. But the book is got some context in it, little, but it's basically, it's Paul's words. It's his book, not mine. I was just there to kind of write it all down and record stuff. Not everything he's done has been great, but hopefully this book frames the whole thing and perhaps shows that why some parts of what he's done, some periods, some elements, some records are better than others. But I mean, there were some points. I mean, I one of my favourite Weller songs is Bull Rush from the first album. It's a real earworm for me. I mean, I sing it most days, much to my wife's annoyance. And he shrugged his shoulders and said, couldn't tell you anything about that, mate. It's just, you know, Bull Rushes. And I quite like that.
Let's talk that purple period, or the purple years, as you frame it. So 22 Dreams, he talks about being such a pivotal record for him in so many ways. But initially, it was that it gave him confidence, which just seems ludicrous, doesn't it? Here's a fellow who's at that point, we're 30 years into a career. And it's at that point, it gave him confidence to really do what he wanted to do with his music.
Yeah, and I can see how that sounds like a pivotal moment or a pivotal thing to say. But he'd already had sort of 30-odd years of incredible experimentation before that. And each section of his career was almost a denial of the previous work in a very modernist way. I've done that. I'm going to do something separate, which is why I think that what he considers to be his failures really sit with him, because for him, like many artists, not all artists, it's all about forward motion. It's all about the next thing. I've done that. It was great. It was successful critically, commercially, but I want to do X. And that's really important. And also that drives culture. It changes culture. It changes people. It changes people's lives.
But that confidence is so important, because he also talks about the fact that it was only 10 years ago or around about 10 years ago that his confidence as a writer really kicked in. There is a lot of this innate insecurity that comes through in the book at points.
But how brilliant that insecurity has resulted in the body of work that he's produced in that 10 years. Because it's all very well having the insecurity and then developing the ability and the confidence to do something. But as we've said, that doesn't often happen with people. There's lots of people who can reconstruct the architecture of what went before in terms of mode, in terms of tone, in terms of musicianship, color, length, everything. And if you ain't got the songs, you ain't got the songs.
There was some lovely, I mean, I know you weren't prying into his private life and stuff, but family is obviously such a big part of his life, and always has been a connection to the band as well, obviously with, you know, his mum and sister running the fan clubs and all that. But John Weller, and there are some lovely moments where he talks about John, his dad, but also his manager, obviously. And Be Happy Children, one of the songs that you talk about, being one of these moments in where he talks about his dad so lovingly. I guess that's just coming out in the natural flow of conversation rather than you trying to get moments like that.
Yeah, because we're talking about the work. And there were the inspiration for some of these lyrics were quite revelatory to me. I mean, there might be, you know, keener students of his work, someone like you or whoever, who have perhaps done more research into some of these same things, but often I would find what he said about something quite remarkable, because they were coming from a place that I didn't expect. And I think that where he talked candidly about his parents, father, his kids, some of that does come out. But again, it comes out in ways that he wants it to come out. It wasn't a book about that. It's not a book about his life. It's a book about the work. And inadvertently, when you talk about the work, those personal things come out.
Now, somebody who loves that creative process as well, there are elements where at times we're talking about the creation of the records too. I've always loved these stories that come through on the podcast, this change of studio techniques. So he talks about Saturn's Pattern and the move over to Pro Tools. And I thought, this is brilliant, right? So I know I said no spoilers, but this is a really lovely moment where one of the reasons for that, they actually ran out of the multi-track tape and it became so expensive, like 150 quid a roll, that's why they really truly embraced Pro Tools, just because of costs.
Necessity, that's what drives a lot of technology. Come on.
That's very true. When the book arrived, I saw a little video on Instagram of you unpacking. You must have been like, oh my God, this, because it is absolutely stunning. And it's not just the words, it's the conversation, the songs and all that, but the photographs within it as well. I mean, there are hundreds of photographs from, you know, people who've been on the podcast and not. You must have been so proud when you opened up that package to have a look at this thing, because it is a beautiful publication.
Well, Genesis produced a very good book. And I think that the other thing that Paul is very, very particular about, which probably won't surprise people, but let me tell you, is not typical, is that he looked at every page,
every picture, everything. And it's a yes, no with Paul. It's like, and that's really important because lots of people produce books like this now. Everyone's writing their autobiography or doing a version of, and there are lots of many good, you know, there are very good publishers who are very good at packaging, very beautiful, very heartfelt, emotive, commercially successful books. But I don't think I've ever met anyone who has invested so much of their time in a book as Paul has with this. Interestingly, and kind of gratifyingly, he didn't interfere with any of the text, didn't appear to want to. But then I'm kind of glad about that because the text wasn't meant to be confrontational. It was meant to be presenting him in a way that he deserved to be presented. But everything about, and there were, you know, various false starts about things we were going to include, snippets of poetry, other bits and pieces, and it became more streamlined the more we worked on it. But this is very much a book by Paul. This is Paul's book. And yeah, I'm very proud to have been involved with it.
Was there any parameters? Was there when that you had that first conversation? Was there any were there any places he didn't want to go or you didn't want to go?
No, I remember his first question was, "How long is this going to take?" I remember once at GQ, we just photographed someone, famous person for something, and I met them afterwards at an event, and we got him photographed by David Bailey, and I said, "How did the shoot go?" He said, "It was great. It was short." What people want.
I'll bear that in mind for the finale of this podcast. This is called Magic, A Journal of Song. Where did the title come from? Because there's a bit at the end where he talks about the fact this whole creative process is magic and the fact there's talent, there's skill, but there's a certain amount of magic attached to songwriting, which is really lovely.
It came from both of us. We had a very brief sort of exchange about, he suggested something. I suggested something, and after about half a dozen exchanges, we got to where it is now. And the final title is Pause. And I think it's a perfect encapsulation of what we've done, what he's done, and I'm very proud of it. And I think that if you are a aficionado, or indeed just have a curiosity about his working practices, then you'll really enjoy this book.
I mean, there's a danger with Paul that it's almost as out of date at the moment it's released as well, right? Because, you know, new material around the corner, I'm sure. So.
It's got to be a stinker.
I'll pass that on. Dylan, thank you so much for your time. Really enjoyed our chat. I do have one final question for you. As you'll know, the purpose of this podcast is for me to get to that interview with Paul Weller, okay? Are there any tips, any bits of advice? Obviously, you've been through, you know, hours of conversation to get to this beautiful, beautiful book. This is just going to be a podcast. But come on, let's pass on some of your knowledge, some of your tips for me, my friend.
Don't ask.
Well, don't ask him.
If you don't ask, you'll get. Dan, I promise you, okay?
Thank you, Dylan. Good luck with the book.
Glad you enjoyed it and great to talk to you today. Take care.
Well, there you go. Something a little bit different on this episode. My thanks once again to Dylan Jones telling us all about Magic, A Journal of Song, the new official book by Paul Weller, available as a bookstore edition now, a signed limited edition being sent out very soon. You can order wellerbook.com or check out Waterstones, your local bookshop, all that kind of stuff as well. It's called Magic, A Journal of Song, Paul Weller with Dylan Jones. I like the fact that that all started as well from that little podcast chat that they'd had. It just started out with that. You see, you never know. You never know where this could end up, do you, eh? Hey, look, thanks for listening. More details in the show notes to this podcast, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. You can see a little video with Dylan and Paul Weller there chatting about the book as well. All the details on my website, paulwellerfanpodcast.com. Something very special coming up on the next episode of the podcast. I'm going to connect The Jam with Superman, The Muppets, Dire Straits, Aha, and Michael Jackson's Billie Jean on the next episode of the podcast. Make sure you follow, you subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.